Call the Hess Committee to order. Senator Jones, Senator Josephson, and Senator Fisher are present. And the first item of business today, since we've been requested by our favorite female senator sitting in the audience, Senate Bill 67. So Senator Fakes, we now have Senate Bill 67 before us. Why don't you come and tell us why we should pass it out? And then also, Senator Fakes, there are two people in Anchorage on teleconference that want to testify. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon and to have you take up this bill. My name is Jan Fakes. I represent the State Senate for Midtown, Hillside, and south portions of South Anchorage. The bill is an old friend. It went through the Senate last year, went through several committees in the House of Representatives, and passed away quietly in the Rules Committee of the House in the final hours of the 14th Alaska Legislature. This is an act relating to insurance coverage for the treatment of mental or nervous condition. This bill will require insurers to offer their customers the opportunity to purchase minimum mental health coverage in all health insurance policies sold in Alaska, and will eliminate the discrimination that currently exists between mental health and other medical insurance benefits that exist in the statutes now. A similar bill, as I said, was introduced last year. I think the passage of this legislation is vital to provide Alaskans access to mental health coverage on the same basis as other medical benefits, be it eye care, dental care, internal medicine care, whatever the kinds of medical coverage there is, on the same basis as those medical benefits, and which in turn will shift more of the burden for mental health care to the private sector from the public sector. Currently, 12 states have passed laws which require the policyholders be given the opportunity to purchase mental health insurance, kind of an optional approach. 14 other states take a stronger position. They do not give the policyholders an option, but rather require that minimum mental health coverage be included in every health insurance policy sold within a state. So you have 12 states with an optional approach. You have 14 states with a mandatory, stronger approach. As drafted, this bill adopts the mandatory approach in that it allows subscribers to decide whether the benefits of mental health insurance coverage are worth the added premium cost, and it preserves this option for a collective bargaining process. Senate Bill 67 requires a minimum of 45 days of inpatient treatment and 50 equivalent hours of outpatient treatment per year. These requirements are consistent with requirements in the other states that have this kind of coverage. Presently, when mental health coverage is offered, usually the benefits are much less than those available for other treatment, and insurers will often require that their customers pay a higher deductible or a higher portion of the cost for mental health services. For instance, right now under the state system, the PERS insurance policy that we all have, if you get your appendix out, the state will pay, or the insurance company will pay, 90% of that operation. If you go to a psychiatric evaluation or have psychiatric treatment, or a member of your family does, they pay 50% of the cost. So there's not parity in the type of medical treatments between the various services. This bill would correct that. There would have to be parity.
Thank you.
From 7 to 10% of subscribers use mental health benefits when these are available in their policies, from statistics from other states. And this is approximately the same rate that subscribers use extra care from other medical specialties, whether it be dental care, eye care, or whatever. There's no evidence that mental health benefits are abused at the rate that differs from other health benefits. If insurers are concerned about accountability, they can always subscribe to a peer review service review board, which will review the validity of individual claims. Medical science has long recognized that correlation between physical disease and mental health. Studies have proven that direct treatment of mental health problems result in lower costs for other medical costs, medical care. As mental health treatment becomes more affordable and available to employees, employers report a significant increase in job attendance, productivity, and a significant reduction in on-the-job accidents. Mental health treatment also reduces drug and alcohol-related crime. We have a series of statistics and brochures and all of this that lists this kind of statistical data the committee wishes to have references cited. It is true that mental health coverage will mean higher premium costs to subscribers. However, this cost is not substantial. A national survey of 79 major corporate plans revealed that the average annual premium cost for each subscriber was $29.47 for mandatory mental health care. Finally, there is a cost savings that will be enjoyed by the state of Alaska. Nationwide, the state's governments pay about 50% of the total cost of our mental health bill. When subscribers are given access to mental health coverage on the same basis as other medical benefits, more of this burden will be shifted from the state to the private sector. Senate Bill 67 may indirectly reduce the dependency of community mental health centers in Alaska on state funds. These facilities currently receive matching grants from the state and charge their patients a sliding fee based upon their ability to pay. After the grant is matched, all additional fees are devoted to enhance the programs and expand their facilities. Division of Mental Health personnel report that because of lack of funds, these mental health centers can only provide the services needed to about 20 to 30% of the communities. They predict that with the passage of a piece of legislation like this, that they will be allowed to serve one half or 50% of the community needs. You've got a sectional analysis in your packets that go over each section of the bill. We can go over those if the committee desires. I have my staff attorney, Alexis Gabay, here, and I know there are lots of experts in the audience that can go over the specific details of the bill for you. We are proposing a couple of amendments for the committee's consideration. One, right now we have a mandatory option provision in the bill. In other words, the insurance company, Blue Cross, would come to you as an employer and give you the option. One of the options that they would represent to you would be a mental health package. And you could pick that or the dental package or the eye package. And you'd have that option for mental health coverage before you. I would like the committee to require some kind of mandatory mental health coverage, a minimum package. And if you didn't want it, that they would be obligated to give you some alternatives for mental health coverage. So if you would consider that amendment, and that amendment would be in section one. Then the other one, when we put this bill out to the various communities and hospitals for comments, several of the hospitals came back with a very, very interesting point. In smaller communities, the mental health care is being done by small hospitals. There's not a mental health clinic. There's not a particular psychiatric clinic in the town. The hospital is the center for all medical care. And the way the current language in the bill is drafted in Section 2142-365D, Subsection 3, it's not really clear that there would be a reimbursement for psychiatric care conducted in these small hospitals. So that language needs to be corrected, and we have some recommended language for the committee to look at. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I again appreciate the committee's indulgence in taking up this bill and would be glad to answer any questions.
Hey, thank you. Are there any questions from any members?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Joseph.
Going to the matter of the amendment to Section 1, my recollection is that one time there was a provision requiring that the insurer offer uninsured motorist coverage to the driver and that to the customer, and that the customer would have coverage for uninsured motorist damages unless the customer expressly waived in writing that provision. That's a kind of middle ground, I think, between the amendment you alluded to and what is in the bill. It doesn't say, I'm just offering that as a possible concept here, it doesn't say that you have to have it and pay for it, but that you have to show, the insurer has to have evidence in its file that the customer made a knowing, conscious election and the offer was made.
We do that.
Pardon?
Mr. Chairman, we do that tool? Essentially in other insurance opportunities. Check.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am just convinced that mental health insurance saves medical expenses and that it increases productivity and it saves society in the long run additional costs in the lack of productivity, child abuse, family abuse, all of those kinds of social ills that we have. And so I would like as strong a language as possible, but of course I'm a realist, and whatever this committee, the wisdom of this committee, sees fit in addressing would be okay with me. I would just like to see the coverage get on the books in whatever manner we can get it on, and we can get on with the business of helping people get medically, mentally healthier.
Okay, thank you, Senator. We're going to go to teleconference, and then we're going to go to the teleconference, and then we'll come back. We have four people here that care to testify on the bill. So, in Anchorage, we have Dr. Wolf. Do you want to give your testimony now, please?
Yes. I really, Mr. Chairman, really appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 67. I have worked with Senator Fakes in her office on this now for several years. I am a psychiatrist in Anchorage, president of the Langdon Clinic here in Anchorage, and have been active in the Alaska Psychiatric Association. The Alaska Psychiatric Association indeed has been very active in helping draft the series of bills, including this year's Senate Bill 67, because we really do feel that it will help the mentally ill here in Alaska. It will help them get a wider range of treatment and better coverage, especially for those people who are covered by insurance but whose incomes are on the lower end of the income scale. And there are a sufficient number of people who are in jobs that are covered by insurance but who have very little expendable money beyond their major necessities. And they then wait to get psychiatric care until it's a crisis and very expensive hospitalization is needed. With this kind of floor in this kind of setting, then these people may very well come for treatment at an earlier time. The other thing that Senator Fakes mentioned, and I really appreciated all of her testimony on this and absolutely agree with it, is that the burden for mental health has fallen on the 23 community mental health centers around the state. I was on the original governor's advisory board that helped set that up, and I know that these centers around the state have been shouldering much of the burden for mental health. They are doing this for the populations who cannot afford to go elsewhere in the community at all. And if people could utilize the insurance that they have, that burden in those communities where there are other providers certainly can be spread out and more people can be served. I certainly would agree and have seen it both here in Alaska and nationally that when people utilize their mental health benefits, by and large, their overall medical costs then do drop somewhere in the neighborhood of 10%. I would like to respond also to Senator Josephson's comment about the fact of expressly waiving. The concern, I think, of myself and the Psychiatric Association is that many people, when faced even with a small amount, like $29 or so, might waive at that time a mental health benefit in lieu of eye benefits or dental benefits because no one wants to think that they might at some point in the future become mentally ill. And it really concerns me that if they then waive it, they would not be covered for even the somewhat inadequate mental health coverage that we presently have. And in passing this bill, I certainly wouldn't want to put people more at risk than they presently are. So in whatever form we presently do it, I would really feel it's very important that we maintain coverage for people at some level. Psychiatric Association, as I said, personally, I think that the people of Alaska, especially the mentally ill of Alaska, would be best served by an absolute mandatory bill the way the 14 states that have it would be. I have not seen the exact wording that Senator Fakes has put in, but her staff has run the concept by me, and I'm in agreement with that. Once again, I think this is a very important bill for us as Alaskans to further both our health and mental health. If there are any questions, I really would be glad to answer them. Thank you.
Are there any questions? There's no questions. Thank you. Dr. Smith?
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Dr. Bruce Smith. I'm a psychologist in Anchorage and currently the president of the Alaska Psychological Association. I have 2 points to make with respect to Senate Bill 67. The first point is that when we're talking about coverage for medical, there is a breakdown for dental, there's a breakdown for eye care, a breakdown for mental health coverage in addition to a general category. One of the concepts that we're working with here that I want to underscore is the fact that the mental health coverage has a high interactive effect with other medical coverage. The point was made by Senator Finks, and I want to underscore it again, that utilization rates when people use mental health coverage, the utilization rates for other general medical goes down quite significantly. Pair that with the fact that studies show that of the utilization of general practitioner type physicians, up to 60% of that is people that can be classified as the worried well, who have non-specific symptoms or symptoms that can be addressed either through the avenues that treat anxiety or that treat depression. Second point that I want to make is the definition of mentally ill. We've talked about, Dr. Wolf talked about mentally ill from the perspective of the community mental health centers here in Alaska. Currently in Alaska, the issues that confront the treatment practitioner are those that are related to alcohol and drugs, those that are related to depression, and those that are related to violence in many forms, either sexual or physical or both. Those are, in addition to, let me say that those are a component of our geography, that they are related to Alaska. There are Alaskan varieties to each one of those. I think that those things need to be thought about when we're talking about the mentally ill, in addition to more traditional images that have to do with people who have long-term hospital stays. And it is exactly that kind of population that also needs to be considered in the kind of a coverage that we want to offer. What people do have the possibility from their insurance coverage to gain the treatment that they need. We're addressing large social issues here. Okay, I think that at that point I'd like to stop and entertain any questions.
Any questions? There's no questions here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll go to the witnesses just the way we have them. John George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John George, the Director of the State Division of Insurance. We are supporting this bill for a number of reasons, but we particularly endorse the fact that it is not a mandatory coverage, but is a mandatory offering. Traditionally, the administration, prior administrations, have been against mandating benefits in that they tend to drive up the cost. And for some people, a particular benefit that is mandated may not be appropriate for that group. So, generically, we always prefer the option, and this bill does that. We have a couple of technical amendments that I would like to put forward, and they're mainly in the definitions. And to do those, there'll have to be some renumbering. But the term accumulation period needs to be defined as the maximum length of time in which an insured or subscriber has to incur the amount of covered costs for treatment to satisfy any deductible required. Another amendment would be the term deductible needs to be defined as the amount of covered costs for treatment for which the insured or subscriber is responsible that must be incurred before benefits become payable under a disability insurance policy or subscriber contract in any accumulation period. And the last amendment would be to modify the definition of copayment, amended to indicate that is the portion of covered costs for treatment in excess of the deductible for which the insured or subscriber is responsible. Those are really very technical amendments, and I don't think do any harm to the bill itself.
Excuse me, do you have a copy of that? Because I don't recall seeing it.
I do, and I will give it to the committee. This has today's date on it. This is a position paper I'm reading from. We had three bills scheduled this afternoon, so I'm kind of bringing the papers, and I have not had a lot of time to review this myself. The last item that we would like to bring to your attention is that some medical policies now, health insurance policies, provide scheduled benefits for everything. And the way this bill is structured, it would provide, as by definition, that the benefit would be the cost of the service or the UCR, usual, customary, and reasonable cost. And in some policies, that would be the only coverage in the entire policy that was subject to UCR because for other coverages, they do have a specified limit. You can either allow those types of policies to specify a limit, or you could allow it to go through this way and just recognize that it's different for that particular type of policy. But I just want to bring that to your attention. I'd be happy to leave a copy of this with the committee for your review.
Senator Joseph.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, John, could you explain that last point again?
Okay. Most health insurance policies provide that the insurer will pay whatever the cost of the treatment is, subject to not more than the actual charge by the physician or provider, or the usual, customary, and reasonable amount. So if your doctor charges $1,500 for something that all of the other doctors are charging $100 for, their obligation is $100. And this bill provides that. So UCR is a concept. But there are some policies that don't pay based on what the bill is and don't pay based on UCR. They are a scheduled benefit. In the event that you get eyeglasses, we will pay $50. We don't care what the reasonable amount is, and we don't care what the bill is, we will pay $50. And this bill, the way it is written, even on a policy where there are specific schedule benefits, would say for mental health, you will pay the UCR.
Mr. George, what I'm hearing is that the department or your division supports SB 67 as written, but I'm also hearing the sponsor and the doctors in Anchorage say that they don't want it passed as written. They may want it passed as written compared to what is on the books today, but they want something stronger than a waiver in the form of mandatory coverage. What are the objections from your agency's point of view to mandatory coverage for mental health?
Okay, first of all, let me say that we would not object to your approach where there could be a specific declination of coverage. I think that gives the purchaser of the policy the option, and that so he doesn't have to buy the coverage if they deem it not appropriate. I can't speak exactly to your point because I don't have an administration position on this bill as it would be modified because that wasn't the bill. But I did state earlier that traditionally the administration's position has been on any type of mandated benefit, that we would not support that because there are people that would not need it. And we've had alcoholism treatment, we've had pregnancy benefits and those types of things. And if you were an employer and none of your employees drank alcohol, for instance, but you were required to provide alcohol treatment benefits, would be an example. Now, mental health is a little different because it's hard to select a group and say, well, my employees aren't going to need this because they don't smoke or they don't drink or they whatever. But so I'm not sure what the administration's position would be on that. But we did particularly support this because of the approach in the original bill.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Joseph.
Assume hypothetically that a bill passed with a provision requiring mandated coverage for mental health in the form suggested. If I were the operator of the Denny's franchise in Anchorage and had a group health program for my employees, what degree of additional cost would I be looking at to maintain health coverage for those employees? I guess I'm asking this because I want to know what somebody's going to pay for this additional coverage, and if it's a group coverage, I want to know what that burden is and whether it might tend to make employers decide they weren't going to offer any coverage at all, for example, for any kind of health coverage.
Okay. That's a hard question for me to answer, and we have some people from the health insurance industry here, and maybe they can give a more definitive answer on actual cost. There has been testimony today that it might actually reduce the overall cost paid out under policy, and if that's the case, then mandating it ultimately would result in a savings because there would be less utilization of the policy as a whole. And from that standpoint, you say this is a good deal, we ought to mandate it. If you believe that it will increase the utilization for mental health benefits beyond the savings on the other type, or it won't affect the other benefits, but it will increase the mental health benefits, and there will be an increase in cost, and ultimately has to be an increase in premium. I can't tell you what those differences are, and possibly the health insurers could. We could possibly develop that information, but I don't certainly have it with me today.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Make sure we get a copy of what you're proposing.
Mr. Chairman, could we ask then that the Division of Insurance, knowing the desires of Senator Fakes in the matter, prepare for us a position paper on the proposition, on the other two propositions, one the mandatory waiver and the second mandatory coverage, so we can look at that and know what your best view is.
So you would develop that for us, so we have. We're not going to move the bill out today, anyhow.
Sure. I'm not sure what the proper document for that to be on, but we certainly could come up with a paragraph or two, whether it be a position paper. Position papers have to be, I think, on a specific bill, but we can certainly give you some indications pros and cons and where our position would most likely be in those events. Yeah.
Deborah Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Deborah Smith. I'm the Administrative Officer with the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. Could I ask, just for the record, have you received our position paper?
Yes.
You do. Okay.
Yes.
Basically, our department is in support of this legislation and feels very strongly that mental health coverage should be included in insurance policies offered within the state. Our concern, however, with this legislation lies solely with our belief that at least half of the community mental health centers in the state will not be eligible to receive third-party, i.e. insurance payments, because the centers are not headed up or supervised by the required level of professional staff. Many of the rural community mental health centers across Alaska are headed by individuals with master's degree in social work and are not directly supervised by either a licensed and certified or certified eligible physician, psychiatrist, or licensed psychologist. Consequently, the treatment services provided by employees of these centers could not be billed to the insurance carrier. These centers provide effective treatment programs, and we believe their lack of ability to entice physicians and psychologists to their communities should not be a deterrent to the receipt of third-party payments for the quality care that they provide. Department of Health and Social Services endorses the concept of reimbursing the providers of mental health services for the provision of services which are within the scope of their practice and supervision when properly licensed by the state. Mental health care is such an integral part of the general health care system, and as such should be reimbursable under insurance coverage. However, we would encourage an amendment that would allow reimbursable insurance coverage to be available to all persons who utilize the services of Alaska's 27 community mental health centers. We understand that such an amendment is currently under consideration, and we wholeheartedly endorse such a change to this progressive legislation.
Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is Dr. Morgan again. It was my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong, and the representative of the department can correct me, but on page 3 of the bill, the last paragraph, number 7, A, Roman numeral 3, does include the mental health centers as freestanding entities to be reimbursed irrespective of who their professionals are. That was my understanding of the intent of that paragraph, and maybe I'm wrong, that it's already there without an amendment.
I see where he's speaking. It's our understanding that it does not offer that possibility, but perhaps that's something that we could discuss with Senator Fake's office, particularly in light of the amendments that she's proposing for small hospitals to be considered for reimbursement.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Johnson,
I guess we will hear from the health insurance providers, but I would like to address this comment maybe through the chair to Dr. Wolf. I have some concern about whether by statute we can come along and require that coverage be provided in facilities that, but for our fiat, the insurance provider wouldn't feel qualified. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of groping here, Doctor, but under that theory, we could also just say that anywhere in Alaska, insurance companies will pay for services rendered whether there's a PhD psychologist or psychiatrist in supervision or not. I mean, that, in a way, that kind of compels, it compels the insurance company not just to offer a type of policy, but it also mandates their standards for third-party reimbursement. And maybe you could speak to that, but I'm uncomfortable with doing that.
Is that my name, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yes. I think that this is modeled after the way that Medicaid includes these centers because they are, number one, audited and supervised by the state, and number two, that the supervisors, at least at some level for every center, are the PhD regional supervisors of the Department of Mental Health. That these are not freestanding and that they meet the criteria, at least in general purposes, because the Division of Mental Health itself has supervisors who meet the PhD or MD criteria. So the model for this is the state's own inclusion of these centers under the state's own Medicaid program. I share Senator Justice's concern relative to opening it up too widely, but I also share the concern about provision of services in the rural areas. I have been one who has said for years that each of the rural mental health centers should have some input from an MD or PhD as consultation. That has happened in many of our centers, but certainly not in all.
Go ahead, Senator Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess there are two distinctions. One, it doesn't offend me that the state in handling the Medicaid program, where it's dealing with its own money and federal money under federal regulations, elects to provide that kind of reimbursement, because that's our decision to make. But I guess I'm troubled by the idea that we would compel someone who offers coverage for mental health purposes to offer that where the patient is being treated in a facility that does not have the kind of clinical supervision that an urban center has. And as I understand it, the department's supervision is not mandatorily, at least, on a case consultation basis, but is moreover a regulation compliance kind of review. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay, let the record also show that Senator Cotola and Senator Halford are here. He was, he just popped in. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Did Aaron have any comments?
Mr. Torador.
What did Aaron have any comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Martin Torador, and I represent Blue Cross of Washington in Alaska. You get me all choked up. This bill has been before the houses of this legislature for approximately 4 years now, and I think it has improved all the way along as it has proceeded through committee. I would have to speak today in opposition to a mandated benefit. Mr. George, I think, covered one of the principal things, and that involves cost and the freedom of choice of the groups to determine whether they need what level of coverage, and to determine if that level of coverage would force them out of the provision of benefits altogether. This day and age, with our economy, we are seeing more and more organizations leaving the health benefits program because they just do not make the money to buy levels of coverage that they formerly had. What it boils down to is that purchasers of healthcare benefits are not buying benefits, but they're buying premium. They're saying this is what we have to spend, and this is what we have. What can we get for it? That seems to be a breaking point for many. In regard to cost of regular medical care versus mental health care, I don't have statistics that would prove or disprove it. I read material on both sides. It's saying improve mental health services, cut down on the on medical services. And I read then in the next article that says that mental health services continue forever and have nothing whatsoever to do with the medical services. So I'm going to, at least for today, keep an open mind on that. Dr. Wolf and others have talked about basic mental health. Blue Cross has, for a number of years, included in all of our community health programs, community-based programs, limited mental health benefits depending on what level you purchase. And by provisions of Senate Bill 67, if this offering was declined by anybody, that basic program that we include in all our community rate business would still be available. It would be there whether they wanted it or not. So in essence, there is a mandated benefit. As far as the mental health centers, Blue Cross does reimburse care provided in a mental health center, period. But the groups need to tell us that they want mental health, community mental health center benefit. And then we pay for that service regardless of the expertise, academic credentials of the provider involved. Now, today, basically, I have come to talk about Senate Bill 67, as was presented by Senator Fakes in early on this session. And I did prepare a small piece of information for you, and I think there are 9 amendments. Now, these are not designed to be earth-shaking. They are what I term to be in the nature of housekeeping. We're suggesting that the offering be made for group coverage only. And the reasoning behind this is cost. It costs quite a bit of money to take a non-group application, do it, and our non-group business is all health statement underwritten, our physicians and nurses and what have you will check the applications, and where there are questions and so forth, we will make determinations from a medical standpoint of whether we want to provide coverage for this individual or not. Putting mental health under that would slow down the process for any kind of coverage, and it might delve into areas where the Privacy Act might become involved, and I think it caused quite a bit of dissatisfaction. Another area that we're looking at is in the area of visits. We suggest that the number of visits, or the 50 hours of outpatient care, change to 50 visits. And I think that it's fairly easy to see where the bookkeeping of this sort of thing could kind of be a pain in the neck for the provider, and for it could cause a little bit of a headache for patients who would come into conflict with their provider because they only got 41 minutes and the provider said he got an hour. So I think that the standard 50 visit is probably going to be easier to administer, and I think it would be easier from a provider bookkeeping standpoint. Again, the usual, customary, and reasonable definition is not, it's not defined in the bill. It just says that it's there. And we suggest that this be amplified by letting the contract language determine what is going to be usual, customary, and reasonable coverage. We come now to definition of inpatient. In the bill on It just says that it talks about inpatient means continuous treatment during a 24-hour period in, and then there is a litany of facilities and so forth. But we think that that should be modified, because that continuous coverage for a 24-hour period would cost the patient a good part of his outpatient visits, because the patient would not be eligible for partial hospitalization or passes and so forth. So this would mean that the patient would be discharged and readmitted, and anything that happened during that intervening period would possibly reflect on outpatient services. And I don't think that that is the intent of the bill, and I think that this would take care of that problem. Again, in defining the nervous and mental condition, we're suggesting that on page 3, the A and B, 5A and 5B, have some exception language in there, because the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders and the ICD-9 and so forth, in those areas you're covering not only nervous and mental conditions, but you're also covering addictive diseases, and I don't think that that was the intent. So we have cleaned that up in our opinion, so that the diseases reflected would be the nervous and mental sections of these two manuals. And last, in the definition of an office visit. Office visit, as in the bill, could bounce all over the place, from the back of a pickup truck to the legislative halls. And we're just suggesting that a few words saying it's in the professional services of, and then go to 6A, which is a psychiatrist, and B, a physician, and so forth. Now, in answering Senator Fake's interest in providing care in the small hospitals, we feel by changing the definition of hospital or inpatient care, we feel that that would take care of that, because we would be providing for the care not on a continuous basis, but on a partial day visit or partial day admission. I'll be happy to try to answer any of your questions, sir.
Any questions? Senator Jones.
You mentioned that you don't have any statistics to show there'd be an increase. Is there anywhere in the world that shows that, or is just because you lawyer in the state would be very interested in that and finding that out? We're going to put a law on the books. I think we should know what we're doing here.
As far as the cost to Blue Cross, or the cost that Blue Cross would charge for a mandated benefit, as I believe last year numbers were around $1 million additional premium a year. And I think we had at that time some 840 groups in the state. And of those 840 odd groups, close to 800 of them, 800 groups, comprised organizations of less than 100 people, and a high percentage between, I guess, would be in the area of between 10 and 25. We have an awful lot of the small mom and pops, and this is one of the areas that where people are buying premium and not buying benefits. But I can ask our underwriting outfit to look at the bill and give me some idea as to what it would cost today.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's be important that we find that out.
No, I agree too. My concern is the mom and pop type operation, and I don't want to see something like this come along and force them out of business if it's going to be that much of an extra cost. So the original bill as we have it, Senate Bill 67, with the amendments you offered, then you're satisfied?
Yes, sir. I believe we should be happy with that.
Mr. Chairman, may I make one comment about the number of hours versus the number of visits?
You can, but what I'm going to have to watch is the other people who are testifying can't cut in at any time, you know, and have a comment. I'll allow this, but you're going to have to wait till the end. I'll go around again. I'll allow one more comment from there.
Thank you, sir. The reason that hours were put in was basically for those either adolescents or the chronically mentally ill, where they may need a number of short visits during the crisis that are not in terms of the hour, and I don't think anyone's wedded to this language here, but the flexibility for the chronically mentally ill may need to be seen briefly, but more times, and it certainly wouldn't cost anyone money, so it was in that flexibility that that wording was put in. Thank you for allowing me to do this.
Okay, thank you. Comment?
Well, we feel it would cost in money and perhaps in aggravation, but you know, if it's going to be, it's going to be. We've handled a number of things that have appeared in the same light in the past.
Okay, thank you. Gordon Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a short prepared statement, which I will have copies for your staff shortly. And after I make statements, first I should introduce myself. Gordon Evans. I'm an attorney with Guess & Rudd, and I'm here today to represent the Health Insurance Association of America. And I will be able to comment on a couple of the other statements that were questions that were raised after this short statement. The Health Insurance Association of America, which is called HIAA, is the national trade association of the private health insurance industry. Its members include more than 330 companies, writing over 85% of the health insurance policies written by private insurance companies in the United States. Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans are not HIAA members. Senate Bill 67, as originally proposed by Senator Fakes, would mandate or require insurers doing business in Alaska, and that includes both those companies selling disability insurance policies and hospital or medical service corporations providing subscriber contracts, to offer, and I emphasize the word offer, insurance coverage for the treatment of a mental or nervous condition. While HIAA does not oppose insurance coverage for the treatment of a mental or nervous condition, the association does oppose Senate Bill 67 and any similar legislation which requires, and again I emphasize the word requires, insurers to provide or to make available particular benefits in their health insurance policies for reasons which I will set out. Historically, HIAA has opposed the enactment of any mandated health benefit laws for the following reasons. First, mandated health benefit laws erode the ability of insurance companies to tailor health benefit packages to meet the needs of particular plans and to market group health insurance policies to large plans on a national basis. Secondly, mandated health benefit laws contribute to the rapidly escalating cost of health insurance. And third, mandated health benefit laws promote self-insurance. This legislation would not apply to self-insurers or those with employee welfare benefit plans which are exempted under ERISA, the federal law. In summary, HIAA's opposition to Senate Bill 67 is based on the fact that HIAA favors the preservation of a system that allows the prospective purchaser of health insurance free choice of which risks he or she wishes to cover from among the various coverages offered by competing insurance carriers. HIAA also believes that the choice of how the policyholder spends what funds are available for health insurance should be free of government decrees. That's the official statement, Mr. Chairman. As I said, I do have copies of that I'll make available. In listening to some of the other comments that were made earlier, I have a copy of a bill that was introduced last year in the Nebraska legislature, which we also, a portion of it, we would endorse as an amendment to this bill if, in fact, it becomes a mandated insurance coverage bill, and that is that no legislative proposal to mandate or require the offering of health care coverages or services shall apply to any insurer unless the proposal applies equally to employee welfare benefit plans described in 29 United States Code Section 101 or 1001, etc., and that refers to ERISA plans. That we feel that it should not, it's going to be made applicable to private industry and private carriers, which includes Blue Cross also, in that sense, that it should also be made to apply to self-insurers. Then I had some, I have some documents here which do have some information about various states where they have mandated mental health benefits and what the results have been in those states. And with due apologies to my good friend, Mr. Tirador, I would like to quote from a Blue Cross and Blue Shield magazine. And just point out that in New Hampshire, for instance, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield there found disturbing results of a mandated mental health benefit, no pun is intended. They found that psychiatric inpatient claims have not declined. Hospital length of stay for such disorders has increased. A 54% increase in costs the second year was noted, and a 245% increase in 4 years. And community mental health center rates have gone up 30% faster than the fees charged by private psychiatrists. And there are several other similar comments about in other states, but this points out that I know Senator Fake said there were 35 states that I think had mandates of various sorts, whether a mandated requirement or a mandated offering. This showed 34 states, pardon me. So that have some basis or some level of mandated offerings. And then finally, I do have a report available somewhere that I would be glad possibly to pass on to you if you're interested. On a study that was done in the state of Maryland by HIAA. I don't know what I've done with it now. Here it is. And this is just a summary of the statement, and I don't have all the exhibits to it, is the word I'm trying to think of. But I could probably get those for you if you want them. I'd have to contact the Chicago office of HIAA. But in several of these studies, they have found that mandated benefits account for 12 to 17% instead of the premium costs that are involved in policies. And the greatest portions of that total premium cost are found where the state mandates benefits for nervous and mental health care and maternity and newborn care.
Could you repeat that? You said 12 to 17% of premium cost is mandatory.
And so this is in the state of Maryland, I should say.
All right. Well, so far, this is the only thing I've heard that relates to cost. So 12 to 17% of premium cost is connected with mandatory provisions?
Yes, mandated.
Mandatory provisions. Then you quoted another percentage.
I said that the greatest portion of those total premium costs come from mandated benefits for nervous and mental health care and maternity and newborn care benefits. The statement also points out that mandated benefit costs include indirect costs resulting from increased utilization, administrative expenses, reductions in other coverage, and increased employee contributions to premiums. This also points out that in Wisconsin, mental health and chiropractic facilities ballooned after passage of mandated benefit laws on those two particular benefits. A 1975 Wisconsin law required that all insureds receive $500 of mental health benefits with first dollar coverage. Between 1975 and 1984, the number of outpatient mental health facilities in Wisconsin ballooned from 39 to 939. Anyway, I do have these in just the surveys, which I'd be glad to make copies of and make available to the committee, and I can seek the rest of the information from Chicago on the Maryland Mandated Benefits Report, which was from October of 1985.
Yeah, if you could do that for the committee, I think we'd like to have it. I have a question. What is mandated? What health benefits are mandated by the state of Alaska now?
I honestly can't tell you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe Mr. George
is a list. It is a large list, though.
I'm not sure, Mr. George.
Please. Just
okay. I'm not sure at this point. I could find out. That is, unless there are any other questions, that's all I would have.
But you're fairly certain there are some that are.
Oh yes.
So,
Senator Joseph,
there's a precedent for doing it, at least, right?
Well, there are mandated offerings. Do you mean mandated requirements or mandated offerings?
Mandated. I'm talking about mandated benefits that are mandated. We're talking about adding, as I see it, as to a mandated health benefit, mental health situations.
Are there other things that are mandated?
Well, there are other mandated offerings, Senator, if I may, but as far as mandated required benefits, that, I'm not sure just exactly how many there are there.
Well, how do you read this as a mandated
offering? This is an offering as written.
Only as an offering, not as a required benefit.
That's right. As written, it just requires the insurers to offer this coverage. As Senator Fakes has proposed, it would eliminate on page one, at line 16, it would eliminate the words "an option to receive," and that would take it out of the offering. And it also eliminates the subsection C of that first section, or pardon me, of section 21, 42, 365, which allows you to decline that coverage and accept the lower coverage if an insurer offers it.
Senator Jones.
So in summary, Mr. Evans, you don't believe that the data show that where this kind of coverage is provided, other forms of health care costs go decline.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Joseph, through the information that has been supplied to me by Health Insurance Association of America, I would agree that it does not decline.
Now, one thing I don't understand, from one standpoint, I don't see the problem, because you charge a premium based on your loss experience, so in a certain sense, the state would be directing contracting parties to give you and your client, give your clients more business. I mean, I'd like to have a state law that says that every Alaskan has to have a will. It might help me a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Joseph.
Drafted by an attorney.
Were that only true, usually every time you have a mandated benefit requirement in a contract like this, it also sets a limit on how much your premium can be. And in some cases, it says only 25% above what your usual premium would be. Sometimes it says you can't charge any more than you would under the other circumstances. So it just depends on the wording of the law as it comes down.
Some of the programs do cover, we know of group coverage now, which includes mental health benefits. Some of my colleagues tell me they use that as legislators through the group program. If this is such a dire thing, how does it work out in the categories where we pay a monthly premium and have, and our dependents have, that benefit under the state-negotiated Aetna contract?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Joseph, I think you just hit the nail on the head. Negotiated contract. Some of those benefits are negotiated. Those prices, those premiums are negotiated. And, you know, if you happen to have the contract to supply the health coverage for the state of Alaska, which I believe Aetna has right now, there's a lot of employees involved there. That's a big group. You can probably give a lower premium than you would if you have a smaller company. For instance, my firm of about 70 people, including the attorneys and staff, it's a little bit different. And especially if you get down to a much smaller group.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody else that we missed that cares to give any testimony on Senate Bill 67? Okay, if not, we're going to be waiting on some information that's going to be supplied to the committee. And then chances are we'll come back with a suggested committee substitute for the committee to look at. So with that, we're going to close the hearings on Senate Bill 67. We have the next item will be Senate Bill 169, foster parent training. Okay, for Senate Bill, we have one Senate Bill 169 before us. There are two people that do want to testify. We'll take that first. It's a bill that asked me. I'm just going to refrain from any comments at this point. So we have Yvonne Chase with the Department of Health and Social Services.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. The department is very supportive of foster parent training. And I believe you have our position paper in support of training for foster parents. We're also very aware of foster parents' concerns that over the years the department has not acted in perhaps a very timely manner in providing certain services that I think are essential to foster parents if they're going to be a part of the treatment team and providing services to parents and children. We are concerned, however, that training for foster parents might be more appropriately addressed in administrative policies or at least in regulations rather than statute. But in terms of the training itself, we are extremely supportive of it. I would be happy to answer any questions.
I guess my question is, it's nice to say it would be better done by regulation. What are you going to do about it if we don't pass a law? Is there any definite plan for the training? Because the foster parents, we do have in our packet a letter from the Foster Parents Association, but they do support something on statute. So how would you respond to those folks that if you say, well, it could be better addressed by through administrative procedures, how would you answer that?
I answer that by telling you that we're in the process of developing regulations for foster care. My understanding that those is that those regulations have been in the process for a while. And again, the foster parents have some concern that those regulations may not be forthcoming. I've moved them to the top of the priority list in terms of projects coming out of my division, and we will have them ready for a hearing by the end of this fiscal year. Training can certainly be addressed within those regulations. One other concern just to bring up, and that's the line in the bill that talks about the fact that the training could not be waived. And some concern that if we're not going to provide perhaps some transportation costs for some foster parents who are residing in rural areas, that we may have some difficulty with requiring that they receive training that is in fact pertinent to the kind of care that they're providing.
Okay, this, when you look at the bill, though, we're talking about a licensee shall complete annual foster parent training approved by the department. Doesn't that give you some flexibility to approve it depending upon where they are, a different kind of program or training?
It does, for the most part, yes, except in areas where you would find that there may not be anything that would be available. And then I would think that we would have some responsibility to see that something was available for the foster parents.
Okay, any other questions? Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Jeannie Brown.
I'm Deline Brown. I am a foster care parent here in Juneau. And I would like to support the idea that foster care parents need training. And I'd like to talk about it, see if you have any ideas on maybe why you think it is important. I think that might save a little bit of time. As training is provided now, we're pretty much on our own, as everybody knows. And even though we have several here in Juneau, we are lucky with the Parent Aid Program and others that support foster care training. But I would like to say one thing that here in Juneau, I can talk for the Juneau parents, we like to not be thought of as volunteers. And even though it might not be relevant to the issue, we consider ourselves professional caregivers. And in that light, we consider ourselves needing proper training. Some of the children coming into our care, of course, are needing all kinds of support. Most of them have very many problems, as you're aware of. And some foster parents are needing training in, say, bonding, broken bonding. Some of the kids coming into our care are high-stress families. Some parents need training in the teenage problems of runaways. Sexual active teenagers. There's all kinds of different training that parents need or foster parents need here. And I just would like to support that we have foster training here.
Senator Jones,
you're off the telephone. How do you handle a chronic runaway or a chronic, say, substance?
As a foster care parent myself? Well, I can tell you from personal experience, I have had a 14-year-old girl come into my home, and she walked in the front door, she made one phone call, caught a cab, and I never seen her again. You know, so a lot of these people who are on the run, we call them, and it is a very big problem here in Juneau, as you know, and I know it is all over the state. I don't know for sure if there's anything you can do, but I think that if you can catch them, and I call a lot of the runaways a clicky group, especially here in Juneau. That's all I can tell you, but I know the runaway problem is here. I do know that if they get into a certain group of children, we're talking anywhere from 9 to 14 or 16 years old, if they think they've got a better deal and ran away, they will run away. I worked as a VISTA volunteer here and worked with the Tough Love group. And I can tell you it's a very educational experience to go to some Tough Love meetings here. If they decide that their 14-year-old daughter should be home by midnight and that child isn't able to keep up that curfew, well, maybe even just the parent's authority is undermined. And I work with two fathers with runaway sons, and at 14 years old, the first thing that happened is that the state police will say, sorry, I can't help you. Running away is not against the law. And the cases that I ran into and helped on some of the parents, it's taken them almost 2 weeks to track down. Last year, I went out to UAJ because we had runaways at the dormitories out at UAJ and talked to the housing authority. And in that case, precautions were taken and more people were alerted to the fact that there are runaways. Right here in town, we have people that are on vacation out of town. Oh, invite Johnny over for a week because his parents are having a problem. We give a lot of these runaways too many options. One thing, too, is that when the state does take custody of runaways, sometimes the state isn't able to help these children. And at that point, then they're released back onto the streets. And I find that that is a real problem here. If the state of Alaska takes responsibility for, say, a 14-year-old, and then for some reason isn't able to control that 14-year-old, then releasing him to the street is no answer either. So that's my experience with runaways. It's a very tough problem here. I think basically, as an early educator, I think that we have to start talking to kids before they're the runaway age and working with the parents at an early age.
Mr. Chairman,
is there any way you can recognize a symptom, pick it up earlier than when it actually happens, say earlier than the 9-year-old, say that the 6 to 7-year-old, is there anything that indicates that?
I think it depends on the families. I'm a real big enforcer of families. And when a child is a very insecure child, say for instance the family is not a whole unit, say for instance the child is pretty much left on his own, that child has got no really attachment. Now without an attachment, that child is a potential runaway. And I have known runaways before, say 14-year-old runaway, who has an attachment to her home, but it's so unbearable living at home. It's either a sexual abuse problem with a live-in boyfriend that that child does not want to run away from home, but because of the situation at home, it has no choice and has to run away. So there's really, you know, several different kinds of runaways here. I find almost all runaways that I am personally involved in, of course, is an alcohol drug abuse problem. It, you know, it just automatically goes with the situation. And it's really a tough thing for parents because knowing some of the parents that I know, they're some of the best parents that can be. But because of the situation, they feel like they have failed, and that's not the problem here in a lot of these cases. These are bright kids. They get into a situation. They don't know how to get out of it. And so running away seems to be the clicky thing to do.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, do you see where this bill would provide you with the training that you would need, or people that you know, other foster parents, with training that would actually help them?
Well, I think definitely runaways is some of our biggest problems. Like I say, I think we can start at a very early age. But the foster care parents that I know here in Juneau, a lot of them have that teenage population in their homes. And I can tell you, when you get a 9-year-old who's already been busted for drugs, or you get a 14-year-old who's sexually active, you know, by that time, foster parents have a big thing cut out for them. And I think personally, as successful as they are in their own families, this is just a real knockdown, drag-out fight that foster parents have to go through. And they do need that training to be able to approach these problems. In most cases, very good foster care parents that I know personally have quit. They've just gotten burned out too many times. And so that's what happens to foster caregivers.
Thank you, Senator Jones. Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering if the way to reach a consensus on this, but I don't know what the chair's view is this. The department seems to say that we are moving to have regulations developed. These will be circulated within the near term to foster parents for their comment. We would like the flexibility of doing this by rule. So I assume that the objections of the department are probably to the second sentence in subparagraph B, which has to do with the annual training hours and the
requirements for both adults and foster care families. Which leads me to think that we could go ahead with SB 169 as long as your regulations are moving forward and delete that sentence if the committee saw it that way, which would give you a little more flexibility, and then we could, through our regulation review process, oversee the regulations, and if we got a lot of complaints, we could legislate again or otherwise contact you. I'd like to ask through the chair, Ms. Chase, if that is another way of doing this, because I know I've heard from foster parents wanting a guarantee of movement in this direction, and I would also like to accommodate the department. To be perfectly frank, I think politically, for us to go back to them and say, well, we really wanted to have a law, but the department came in and said they were going to adopt regulations. We haven't seen them yet, and know what the final version of them is, but we've agreed to do nothing. I think that's really hard of us to do that. Can I get your comment?
I'd like to ask you again to cite the line that you...
Well, the bill says at line 19, each adult in a foster home shall complete at least 5 hours, and then says each foster care family shall complete a total of at least 15 hours of annual training. If that sentence were taken out, you would have more flexibility as to what your regulations contain.
I think it's not so much the amount of training, because I don't think that we would have difficulty with that. I think my concern is more with line 26, that the requirements for training under the subsection may not be waived, and that for some, in some circumstances, I would hate to see a foster parent not be able to continue their license when they made the effort to get the training, but perhaps the training wasn't available. And yet, I understand what the foster parent's intent was there, was to be sure that there were not foster parents out there who were not interested and therefore would not pursue the training. So it's the waiver section that I'm concerned about.
Let me follow up on that, though. But let's think about that for a while. If you just look at 17 through 19, it says, to maintain a license issued under this chapter for the maintenance of or conduct of a foster home, a licensee shall complete annual foster training approved by the department. So you have so much flexibility there, and yet you're not waiving it, but the flexibility is such it could be almost nothing.
That's
which would
yes.
probably satisfy. I guess I feel somewhat similar to Senator Joseph. We need to do something. And I have no problem as being a sponsor taking out that one sentence. And then that way it gives you some flexibility to develop something. But if you don't develop something by the next time we come back, since we're all back again next year, then we will then, you know, tell you the specified times or the hours, which I'd rather not do, but we have to get something moving in this direction. I think the thing with me is when I look at the foster parents themselves saying, hey, we need training, that tells me that they really want it. I have a question. Go ahead. That's the fiscal note that bothers me. If we were to take that sentence out, then I wonder how that would affect the fiscal note. Because it should almost be a zero fiscal note, because you're in touch with all these foster parents anyhow every year.
Well, what we looked at in terms of the fiscal note was the fact that the present foster parent contract is a little over $100,000. It does not reach all of the foster parents of the state. It reaches approximately half of them. So we were looking at what it would cost for, through that training mechanism and for other kinds of training that's available through the community college and other professionals in the community, what that cost might be. And it's a guesstimate. Mm-hmm.
But under the, if this were amended to take out, you're basing that also on 5 hours and 15 hours and all this, but if we were to take that out and give you the flexibility, what kind of a fiscal note do you guess would come in? A zero fiscal note, since you already have $100,000 for the program now? Would there be any additional cost then? Or do you want to think about it for a couple of days?
There might be a little extra cost. I'm sure the fiscal note would go down, yes. But
Senator Joseph.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's another way of doing this, which is if you, we could give you like a 2-year cycle to cover the first foster parents in the program. In other words, if you're looking for flexibility, and if you say you're going to be, if I understand you, covering half of them in the first year, we could require that by 1999 that everybody's going to be exposed to, and that gives you another.
Yes, that would be great.
How would you word it, though, if we could just put it on? You wouldn't change annual to semi-annual?
No, I wouldn't do that. No, I wouldn't do that. But I would put in transitional language that says, maybe in terms of the effective date, that I'm not sure if I'd say that completion of initial training under this chapter shall be made available to at least half of the foster parents maintaining or conducting foster homes by the end of fiscal year 1988, and shall be made available to the remainder by the end of fiscal year 1989.
Mm-hmm. Okay, are you proposing that as an amendment?
Yeah. Yeah, I would be glad to propose that as an amendment, that we offer a committee substitute, which I will take it upon myself to have drafted.
Okay, then, is there any objection to the amendment? You guys can unanimously consent.
I ask unanimous.
Okay, that amendment's adopted. And let me ask another question. Do you want to also make the amendment to delete it? With line 19, well, that sentence from 19 to 22.
I would move to strike the second sentence into subparagraph B. Lines 19 to 22, Mr. Chairman.
Objection? Okay, then that is tricky. Also, can you get us a new fiscal note?
Yes.
Based on what we just did?
Yes.
Okay.
Just one more thing.
Yes.
When talking about money, we are not paid salaries as foster care parents. But of course, we get approximately $15 a day for the care of that child. But when you compare it to the cost of what the child is going to cost you at institutional care, I guess you've heard this before. And I think that that's something we've got to think about. And I'm telling you, in my experience of myself, that you're losing good foster care parents. And I did a survey in UAJ this December. Two main concerns of foster caregivers, and it was lack of communication and lack of training. So I think that told the story.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay. Mr. Chairman, with that adjustment, the fiscal note should be coming down to 0.0, shouldn't it? If you can do this over a 2-year cycle.
Senator Jones, yeah.
Nope.
Good. Good job. What's the wish of the committee? To wait until we see what it looks like, or do we want to pass it out now?
Pass it out.
Okay.
I move to pass it out with a recommendation. CS.
Objection? Okay. CS for 169 is passed out. We're not going to take anything else up right now. We were going to get into another Senate bill, 116. And we're going to let that go to a later date. I could have said something to you before. But I thought you were
thanks a lot. Of.
And then,
okay. This is a CS?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.